This year marks the 50th anniversary of Lyndon Johnson's war on poverty. And all this year, we've been talking about what poverty is like in America today. Yesterday, we talked about what researchers found out about race and poverty when they studied 800 poor children in Baltimore for more than a quarter century and found out how poverty shaped their lives. Today, though, we're telling you about one woman's story, a story of someone who never thought she would struggle financially or need public assistance. And then life happened. It's the story of Darlena Cunha. She's a freelance journalist who wrote a piece for The Washington Post titled, "This is what happened when I drove my Mercedes to pick up food stamps." The piece exploded on the internet. It became one of the most widely shared pieces ever on The Washington Post website. And she's with us now to tell us more from member station WNPR. Thanks so much for joining us. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So for people who haven't yet read the piece, set us up for us. You were working as a journalist. Your boyfriend and husband was working as a journalist. You both had good jobs. You both had decent educations. Life was going well. Then what happened?
Yeah, everything was on the up and up. And we ended up pregnant with twins, but we were both working. So we bought a house to prepare for that because we had been living in a studio apartment. And you know, we moved in and I kept working as a television producer up in Boston, and we lived in Manchester, Connecticut. So it was a 90-minute drive, but no problem. And he continued to work up until about 2 weeks before they were born, when he was laid off in, I think it was the second round of layoffs at the Hartford Courant.
So your husband's laid off and then the kids were born premature, which means they were
at 34 weeks, and so
they needed some extra support, right, in the hospital. And then the house that you bought, what?
It completely, obviously, went underwater. We had paid $240 for it, and by the time the twins were born, it was worth just barely $150. And without his income, we couldn't afford the mortgage payments for the $240, which had he continued working, we would have still been able to pay that even though the house was upside down. But he wasn't. And so we started leeching out funds into that mortgage and the utilities and everything, just trying to stay afloat. We had used up a large portion of our savings to put a decent down payment on that house. So it was shocking and very, very hard. And it happened very quickly.
You write in the piece, in just 2 months, we'd gone from making a combined $120,000 a year to making just $25,000 and leeching out funds to a mortgage we couldn't afford. Our savings dwindled, then disappeared. So I did what I had to do. I signed up for Medicaid and the Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for women, infants, and children. So tell us about, you know, that saga. This is kind of where the piece really begins. And by the way, it's not food stamps, it's WIC, which is a different program for the sticklers who need to know the difference.
Yes, I've been correcting that everywhere. As soon as that published, I talked to the Washington Post and I asked them three different times to change.
We get the picture. So tell us what are some of the main sort of impressions of the piece. I mean, first there was how hard it is to get that assistance, right?
Right, exactly. People think you can just make a phone call and it's done. And in 10 minutes, you're collecting your vouchers or your EBT card and you're getting your food. And that's not what happens at all. You have to call and explain your story. And then they require all kinds of proof, like your Social Security number, your birth certificate to prove who you are, marriage license to make sure that your spouse isn't making any money, pay stubs for the past 3 months to ensure that you don't have any extra income and that you're being honest about it. All kinds of paperwork are required. And then after you do that and you travel all around to get that paperwork, which is hard for some people, and you send it in, then you wait because it has to be processed. So you've gone and you've bared your soul. And now you're stuck in this purgatory of, am I poor enough to deserve assistance? Am I going to be able to feed my family? And that waiting period can be any time from a couple of weeks to a couple of months, depending on how bogged down they are. And in 2008, they were pretty bogged down.
So then you get your coupons eventually. Using them is a whole other experience. You've got so many stories in your piece. I think the kind of the bottom line, though, of these pieces is just how many people felt free to offer you advice, or can we put it this way, a judgment or advice about you or your life just based on the fact that you were using some form of government support. And a lot of that centered on your husband's car, right? Hence the headline, because right. There was a point at which you drove your husband's 2003, Mercedes, which he'd bought before you got together and was paid off to pick up your coupons. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? What reaction people had to that?
Mm-hmm. That part of the piece really relays how one feels when they're driving a nice car in their own selves to pick up food assistance like that. So I went in and I didn't look in any direction, just straight ahead. You know, I was aware that there were people's eyes on me, but I couldn't tell you what their facial expressions were, because over and over in my mind, I was thinking, and that shocked me too, because I'm pretty open-minded, but I was thinking, like, what are you doing here in this nice car? You shouldn't be on assistance, not because it shouldn't happen to you, but because you have nice things still and you don't deserve this. And so there's an inner component also to this new kind of broke, this new I have no money, this new poverty that people aren't really aware of because it's under the surface, where you judge your own self and think, I have done everything wrong. This is a personal failing and I don't deserve government assistance because I did this.
You're talking about that once when you had to drive the car, you drove the car to pick up your aid, and you felt people like looking at you. Although you do say in the piece that there were people, mainly relatives and friends, people you did know personally, who kept telling you, why don't you sell the car? One person saying, well, you know, your husband needs to sell that car. He doesn't get to keep his toys now. Why didn't you sell it?
There's a lot that goes into selling a car, and it wasn't worth that much. It would have been worth about $5,000. Had we sold the car and got that $5,000, even if we didn't buy a second car and somehow made it on one car, which we couldn't, we would spend that $5,000 in another 3 months, because it took my husband 22 months to find work. And 3 months later, I would have had to apply for assistance.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Darlena Cunha. She's a former television producer, now a freelance journalist, who wrote an attention-getting article for The Washington Post titled, This is What Happened When I Drove My Mercedes to Pick Up Food Stamps. And Darlena reminds us she was actually picking up WIC, not food stamps, for the sticklers. You said, the most embarrassing part was how I felt about myself, how I had so internalized the message of what poor people should or should not have, that I felt ashamed to be there with that car getting food, as if I were not allowed the food because of the car, as if I were a bad person. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
It took me by surprise, because I consider myself, you know, fairly liberal, and, you know, I really agree with all the social programs. I think human beings have the right to get assistance when they need it and you know, eat, and I feel like I have no judgment about that. And yet when it happened to me, I judged myself. That is really hard to work with, especially when you're trying to now dig out and move forward. Because when you're stuck in a situation like that, the first thing you have to do is move. You know, you have to keep running. So you're dragging yourself down because there's this undercurrent of self, not hatred, but, you know, self sadness and disappointment. There's an undercurrent of disappointment in yourself that shouldn't be there, because, I mean, this crash affected the housing market and job market and everyone in the nation. And I think a lot of individuals thought it was their fault.
What insights do you think that you gained from this experience? And I do want to mention, now you're okay. In fact, you're making enough, her husband's making enough that you can actually go back to school and support your education. But what did you learn from all this? I mean, I want to talk about intellectually as well as emotionally. So tell me what you think you got from this experience that you didn't know otherwise.
I got a lot of gratitude for the system that I didn't have otherwise. It was eye-opening to me in the way that where I could always talk about it before on an idealistic level, I never really was able to understand it or empathize with what people must go through. Another huge part of this that I learned was going to the offices to pick up the coupons and making friends with the people that were there in a way that I could not have before really helped me to see how these programs are helping and how they could help better. Because a lot of the times, you know, people get so stuck on, oh, you're going to be on assistance for life and you know, you're never going to make your way out of it. And these people are working, you know, 3 and 4 jobs, and they've got little kids and they've just been, you know, down on their luck. And they don't have the privilege that I had. I mean, what I walk away from with this is how very privileged I really was. I mean, I always knew it, but now I really know.
Let me ask you this. You could have passed for middle class, right? Never having had this experience, in the sense that, and I mean that kind of euphemistically, you could have gone on after having had this experience, learned whatever you're going to learn from it, and keep it to yourself. Not tell anybody that you had gone through this, and just now that you've kind of regained your footing, why did you want to share this?
I thought it was something that wasn't talked about enough, and I had hidden it. My friends and family didn't know how bad it was. Of course, they knew that we had hit tough times, but they didn't know exactly what had gone on. I thought it was a unique story that didn't happen to too many people because I hadn't heard any stories about this. And
are you glad
that wasn't the case?
How do you feel now that you got it out there? How do you feel now that you put it all out?
There are a couple of different feelings. It is a personal story. So the amount of attention it has gotten has been hard because I'm not without embarrassment, but it's so important and it's so great that it did go huge because people are now talking about a very, very important thing that had been ignored or shoved under the rug. And just assumed that, you know, it's one of those things you don't talk about at the dinner table. So now that it has gone very, very wide, I am happy to have served the purpose of a starting point for a very important discussion we need to have about what happened in 2008 and what people are doing about it even still today to get themselves out of that hole.
Darlena Cunha is a former television producer, now a freelance journalist, and a mom to twin girls. She writes for the Huffington Post and Thought Catalog, and we're talking about her piece, which was published in the Washington Post. It's titled, "This is What Happened When I Drove My Mercedes to Pick Up Food Stamps." Darlena, thanks so much for joining us. Good luck to you and your family.
Thank you for having me.
The nation's oldest civil rights organization, the NAACP, begins its annual convention tomorrow in Las Vegas, and it does so with new leadership. Civil rights attorney Cornell William Brooks was elected the organization's 18th president this spring. He takes the reins of the group at a time when the very definition of civil rights is being challenged and reimagined, and when young people frequently see activism as something that happens online rather than in the streets. In addition to his legal experience, Brooks also brings a faith perspective to this new post. He is a fourth-generation ordained minister serving in the African Methodist Episcopal Church, and we're interested in his vision for the organization, so he was nice enough to stop by our Washington, D.C. studios before he heads out to the convention. So Cornell William Brooks is with us now. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Is it congratulations or condolences?
I would say congratulations, and I would say condolences with respect to those who stand in opposition to America's highest values.
What would you say is your top priority?
Well, the threshold challenge is obviously the strengthening of the Voting Rights Act. But there's also an operational challenge, namely reaching out in a multi-generational way and a multi-ethnic and multicultural way. So in other words, the nation's largest, oldest, strongest, most revered civil rights organization is in a place where we want to welcome into the ranks of membership and leadership a new generation of civil rights leaders. We've done that throughout the years. As you well know, 10% of our board seats are reserved for young people.
Let's set aside the reaching out to young people. Let's set aside the membership piece for a minute and just talk about the issue challenge. You mentioned the voting rights issue as the preeminent challenge. Some people don't think that's true. Some people think it's really education, the quality of education. I mean, Brown versus Board of Education, where the NAACP was a critical factor, if not the critical factor in that. So some people say, you know, education is the civil rights issue of our time, not voting rights. Voting rights takes care of itself. What's your take on that?
Sure. I would say there's a profound relationship between voting rights and education. As you well know, education in the main takes place at a local level in terms of funding. And so your ability to elect local office holders, municipal office holders, county office holders, state office holders, has everything to do with the quality of your schools. And one of the means of doing that is not merely the classroom, but the ballot box. Critically important.
By the standard of events that have occurred, where many people who are in the civil rights community, who are involved in civil rights, as it's traditionally understood, you know, voting rights, criminal justice issues, fairness, one could argue that these organizations are in retreat or have failed if you consider that issues like the Stand Your Ground laws or the duty to retreat laws, which are in the news again because we just observed the one-year anniversary of the not guilty verdict in the shooting death of Trayvon Martin. If you observe efforts to enhance the requirements for voting in states around the country, one might argue that given that the legal initiative all seems to be moving in that direction, then these organizations have failed or are failing.
I would argue, not surprisingly, the exact opposite. So in the criminal justice realm, while in fact we have these stand your ground laws and much work needs to be done, but let's consider this. When we consider the brutal efficiency of the school-to-prison pipeline, the fact that we have a U.S. Attorney General who is reassessing this and has thrown his leadership behind dismantling that pipeline. When we think about the fact that we have banned the box laws passing all across this country, when you use the words mass incarceration, people know what you mean. The point being here is we're really beginning to make a difference. Let me give you a concrete example. One of every three young people will be arrested by the age of 23.
You mean young black people?
Young people in general. One out of every four adults has some kind of a criminal record, 65 million Americans. When you fill out an employment application, quite often you're asked the question, have you ever been arrested or convicted of a crime? If you check the box, yes, no matter how old the crime, how irrelevant the crime, how nonviolent the crime, that will consign your employment application to the circular file,
If there was no forward movement on the charge. I mean, one can be arrested without a matter having been adjudicated.
That's precisely it. And many employers will simply do a Google search, and that will constitute the entirety of their criminal background check. That alone will consign many people to the circular file or the trash can. The fact that we have states all across the country and cities and municipalities passing these laws has a lot to do with the fact that the NAACP worked with certain national employers to get them to change their policies, not the least of which would be Walmart. We see companies like Target. We see hospitals like the Johns Hopkins Medical Center, which have changed their policies. The point being here is we have a civil rights organization taking a concrete stand, working with companies, working with legislators in very specific ways, and then we're beginning to turn the tide in ways that will have a dramatic and profound impact on people seeking work who have criminal records.
Your predecessor, Ben Jealous, made a point to reach out to LGBT Americans, and the organization went on record in support of marriage equality or same-sex marriage, as you prefer. That did not sit well with some of the faith leaders who have been kind of core supporters. And I just wanted to ask you, as yourself as an ordained minister, whose Book of Discipline does not, in your tradition, does not support same-sex marriage, does not support marriage equality, and you are now the head of this organization, which is on the record in support of this initiative, how do you reconcile those two? Do you feel you even have to?
Well, I don't think there's any necessary conflict between a civil definition of marriage and the theological definition of marriage. Namely, churches, synagogues, mosques have traditionally defined marriage in theological terms. That is their right. That is their purview. There's nothing that we're supporting as an organization that would in any way circumscribe or curtail that right. Everyone has that right. But with respect to our country, taking a position on Americans having the right to love whom they love, form families and relationships based upon their rights under the Constitution, the NAACP took a very clear stand. And I will serve my church faithfully. No one has called into question my ability to serve my church as a consequence of taking a very clear position with respect to a right under the Constitution. And I don't believe anybody will.
So you will not be marrying people of the same gender in your capacity as a minister of the AME Church, but
yes,
you will support the right to marry.
Absolutely.
In your capacity as president of the NAACP.
Absolutely.
How does that sit with you?
I'll put it this way. I believe in the work that I'm doing as a civil rights lawyer. I serve my church, and I've tried to serve my church well and faithfully. I'm not trying to square every civil rights position with every theological position of the church. I don't think anyone could do that and do it well. You either have the time to do one and not the other, or the other not the other.
It's a complicated question, but there are a number of organizations that have a rich legacy that people feel, proud of or happy to know about or are glad they did what they did, but just people just don't see as being really relevant to what they're doing today. Many people feel the same way about their faith organizations that they grew up in, for example. I mean, many people are glad they grew up in church, but they don't know, go now. They think that's nice, that's for my parents.
Right.
That has nothing to do with me. And I'm sure some people feel that same way about the NAACP. Is that okay with you, if that's the future, or if that's not the future you see?
It's not the future at all. The NAACP will never be an anachronism. The NAACP will never be a relic of a bygone era. All I would say to you is this. You ask any young person who's ever been stopped and frisked, is the NAACP relevant? Ask any middle-class professional, African-American, who's ever been detained, not because they're driving recklessly, but because they're driving a nice car, an Audi, a Mercedes-Benz. Ask anyone who's ever been a victim of housing discrimination, the kind of people I used to represent at the Justice Department, and they'll tell you that the NAACP is relevant now. It is not a creature of history.
How do you account for something like, speaking of housing discrimination, something like the Los Angeles chapter giving an award to Donald Sterling, the once and possibly still owner of the Los Angeles Clippers, when there was a demonstrated record of his having discriminated against people of color? How does something like that, and not only that, his own, you know, coach and general manager who sued him, even though he lost, mm-hmm. but made the same kinds of allegations that have now come to the fore about this very disrespectful, demeaning attitude mm-hmm. toward blacks and Latinos. How does something like that happen?
Clearly, that was a mistake. It was a mistake. But I think it's also important for us to take note of this. When you think about a young baseball player by the name of Jackie Robinson, who for over a decade raised money for the NAACP to open the doors with respect to not only diversity on the field, but diversity in the front office. The NAACP has long been the means by which sports, entertainment, business in this country have been opened up to people from all walks of life. And so in terms of Mr. Sterling, nothing can justify that. But what's really important for us to keep in mind is that was one mistake, but it doesn't obliterate a record.
Why did you want to do this, John?
I love this organization. I love the work that it represents. Growing up as a little boy in Georgetown, South Carolina, I had a grandfather. And my grandfather ran for Congress in the wake of the Smith versus Allwright Supreme Court decision outlawing the all-white Democratic Southern primary. He did that because he believed in the NAACP and wanted to excite people and engage people to enter the ranks of what I believe to be the greatest band of freedom fighters this country and this world has ever known, namely the NAACP. Talk to people who find themselves made vulnerable by people who are trampling upon their rights and ask them the first name that they think of when it comes to protecting their rights. That name would be the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People.
Cornell William Brooks is the new president and CEO of the NAACP. He was kind enough to join us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Mr. Brooks, Reverend Brooks, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Now, you might have heard recently that comic book giant Marvel is making some changes to one of its biggest characters. The blonde-haired, blue-eyed Steve Rogers will be stepping down as Captain America. Taking his place is his trusty partner, Sam Wilson, also known as the Falcon. He was the first African-American superhero in mainstream comics and the first superhero of color to get his own action figure. The duo's latest film, Captain America: The Winter Soldier, is this year's blockbuster hit. So we thought this significant moment in comic book history was a good opportunity to revisit my conversation with actor Anthony Mackie, who played the Falcon. He started by telling me about his character.
The interesting thing about the character is he kind of is the embodiment of what African-American culture is in this country throughout the course of his comic book life. He was first introduced in 1969, and he was a hustler in Harlem. You know, and if you look at African-American culture at that time, we were coming out of the war. We had a lot of stuff going on with us where we were trying to figure out how to move on as a people from desegregation and things like that. Mm-hmm. And then if you look at his second incarnation, late 70s, they moved him to L.A., and he was a pimp drug dealer. And that was in the midst of the black exploitation period. So basically, they took what we consider to be a strong black figure and made this, you know, comic book hero, this action hero, him.
So what did you like about the role, and why did you want to do it?
I feel like Marvel has a way of bringing a level of humanity to all their characters. I think superheroes are superheroes, but a superhero with flaws and failures and disappointments makes him human and relatable. I wanted to be part of the continuing evolution of the film industry. I feel like if you look at it, it used to be date night, where older people, parents, grandparents would go to the movies and watch a movie on the weekends and things like that. People would dress up to go to the movies. But now it's more of a kid-friendly, youth-friendly medium where parents don't go to the movies. They watch Netflix and send their kids to the movies. So I feel like in order to evolve as an actor in this business of film, you have to be able to grow with the continuously evolving market.
Oh, and you just wanted to wear the spandex. Come on.
And I wanted
Come
spandex
on.
From head to toe. Spandex it
you wanted
all spandex.
Show off your
everything.
Cut. You wanted to show off the six
well,
pack. Come on.
I mean,
on.
I worked out for 6 months before this movie. So I made very clear to them that if I'm going to get 6 months in the gym, I want everybody to know I was in the gym.
Well, congratulations. I think they do. But the fact is, you know, you are a Juilliard trained actor, and mm-hmm. you have made your mark in the kinds of films that may not be on, you know, 500 screens, but that people remember and mm-hmm. that they talk about for years afterward. Mm-hmm. And you've also been part of some very important plays on and off Broadway. You are so busy. And
well, how, if you don't work, you don't eat.
But I hear you, but how do you, and as I understand it, you have kind of an entrepreneurial background. You grew up in New Orleans, do I mm-hmm. have it right? And then
right.
your dad was a roofer and your mom. Mm-hmm.
My mom was a stay-at-home mom. I have a brother who's a motivational speaker.
I also have a brother who owns a bar restaurant in New Orleans,
and I have three sisters, so I come from a very large family.
But entrepreneurial, I mean, like people
yes.
are kind of making their own luck, as
very
it were,
much
right?
So. Very much so.
How do you go about creating your own career, picking your roles?
You know, it's funny you bring up the stuff that I did and where I am in my career. My representatives went after this role for 5 years before I got it. I mean, we literally emailed Marvel every 6 months for 5 years.
Because?
Because I wanted to be in a Marvel movie. And we knew that the rate in which my career was going, that sooner or later they were going to be making a movie that I would be right for. So it's better to send a shot across the bow to let them know we mean business than to wait and be retroactive and have them find us. We're going to let them know we're here.
Well, congratulations. Hopefully you'll come back and see us. Now that you're big and major, you know, you're the Falcon. And
I'm just a superhero from New Orleans.
Before we let you go, that I read a quote from you in one interview saying you don't think you could be a superhero in real life. Instead, you'd be the bad guy. And if you could actually fly, it would be a big problem for everybody involved. I have a hard time. What's up with that? You seem like a pretty nice guy.
No, I'm definitely a nice guy. I'm a pushover. But I would love to be a bad guy. There's nothing more fun, nothing more easy. I would sleep well every night knowing that I'm a bad guy.
Anthony Mackie plays the Falcon in the film Captain America: The Winter Soldier. He spoke to me in April this year. Now it's time for our weekly visit to the barbershop, where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in the chairs for a shape-up this week, our writer Jimmy Israel, with us from Cleveland, from Boston, healthcare consultant and contributor to National Review Online, Neil Minkoff, sports writer and journalist and professor Kevin Blackstone joins us in our Washington, D.C. studios, along with Paul Butler, law professor at Georgetown University. Take it away, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Hey, fellas.
What's up?
Jimmy.
What's going on?
Welcome to the shop. How we doing?
Great.
Doing great.
Beautiful day
doing
here in
good.
D.C.
That's
yeah.
right. What's up?
All
good day
right,
for
well,
bike riding. Good day for riding
yeah,
your bike.
Yeah, well, parlez-vous français, because, you know, it's one of those days, because let's get things started. All eyes are on the Tour de France. I'm not talking about that 12-inch by Kraftwerk. I'm talking about the sports event. Shout out to Kraftwerk. I'm kidding. Most Americans actually care more about badminton. KB, Kevin Blackstone, you're the sports guy.
Hey, right.
The World Cup brought out American fans. Why aren't there more Tour de France parties?
Because there's no Lance Armstrong. I mean, let's face it. Everybody got tuned in to Lance setting all these records over there. He became international phenomena, and now he's not there. And his ignominious departure under the drug cloud, I think, really spoiled it for everybody. It spoiled it for me. I'm a cycling fan. I've covered a few Tour de France. In fact, I rode my bike in today. But I must admit that after tuning out the Tour de France for a couple years, I'm tuning back in this year. And check this out, Jimmy.
There's okay.
There's a brother riding for one of the French teams.
Just one? Clutch the pearls. Holy mackerel, we making our way up in the world, huh?
Well, what's his name?
His name is Kevin Leroy. Reza. R-E-Z-A. He rides for Team Europa Car.
Oh. And you just like him because he's a Kevin.
Well, that too.
Right.
Yeah.
So well, I'm tuning
right.
in.
Neil likes it, right? Neil, were you watching?
Absolutely not, actually.
Okay.
I was
right,
the one who was confused as to why it wasn't. I mean, I think part of it also is not just the no Lance, but the fact that, you know, it's a sport that seems inherently dirty, and I think that really changed the way we view it.
Well, wow. I mean, that makes sense to me. Kevin, just briefly on this, yeah. Do you think that that's the
it
case?
That,
if you feel like there's no way you can win, because Lance Armstrong's point is you can't win unless you cheat.
Absolutely
do you
correct.
Think that's
it's
true.
It's the dirtiest sport I've ever been around, and there is an entire culture of cheating in the Tour de France that goes back to the early years of the Tour de France. In fact, the first winner of the Tour de France won it a few years later. And he got disqualified after they found out he took a train between a couple of the points.
Oh, stop.
Wow.
So they've been cheating for a long time at this sport.
Oh, man. That's
wow.
rough. All right, Jimmy.
Well, you know, much like Lance Armstrong, Lynn Bias' athletic career was badly tarnished by, you know, shortly after the University of Maryland basketball star was drafted by the Boston Celtics in 1986, he died of a cocaine overdose. Well, now the University of Maryland plans to induct him in their Athletic Hall of Fame, and some people say that's just not right. Neil, as our resident sports fan, does he deserve a place?
I think that he does deserve a place. I am against these sort of moral cause, moral ideas of keeping someone with great talent out of a Hall of Fame. What's wrong with having someone in the Hall of Fame? And on his plaque, it says, greatest basketball player in Maryland, died tragically due to drugs. Or why can't Charlie Hustle, you know, why can't Major League Baseball build a wing like the Bad Apple wing that has a plaque up that says, Charlie Hustle, more hits than anybody, gambled on baseball, lied about it. It's just part of the fabric of the sport, and trying to ignore or pretend that the all-time hit leader and eventually the all-time home run leader or someone with the talent of Len Bias didn't exist is pointless.
The Bad Apple wing, ladies and gentlemen.
That's funny. Kevin, what
Professor...
do you think? Yeah, what do you think?
I agree with Neil. I don't want the Bad Apple wing, but what I would like is to have athletes put in the Hall of Fame based on what they do on the field or on the court. But I'd like their entire narrative to be a part of that. And so with Lynn Bias, I want it to be known that he died because of a cocaine overdose, that there was a Lynn Bias bill that was written, that this led to three strikes and you're out, all these sorts of things. I want the Cooperstown Baseball Hall of Fame to acknowledge that the most important person in the 19th century is a guy they have enshrined there by the name of Cap Anson, not because of his managing record, his playing record, all that, but because he's the guy that drew the color barrier.
So the sport was integrated before players of color, before black players.
Fleetwood Walker is the player that he refused to play against, and he got everyone else to agree.
What do you think, Paul?
I wish my brothers in the barbershop would get off their freaking high horses. Lynn Bias was not a bad apple, and his playing career was not tarnished. His death was a tragic accident, but who among us has not done something wrong? I mean, President Obama used cocaine. Are we going to call him a bad apple? Give me a break.
Right. Really?
Mm-hmm.
I agree.
So you think it shouldn't be mentioned? You think he should be inducted into the Hall of Fame, but it shouldn't be mentioned? The circumstances of why he never had a professional career shouldn't be mentioned.
Dude had mad basketball skills. He brought U of Maryland tons of fame and money. That's why he should be in the Hall of Fame.
Jimmy, what do you think?
I think what you do away from the thing you're being recognized from for is inconsequential. I mean, you know, I don't know. Jimmy Carter was a pretty decent leftist president, but he wasn't a great disco dancer. So do we take that in his bio? I mean, who cares? I mean, he was a fairly decent president. Yeah. This guy, decent basketball player. Who cares if he ate cornflakes, you know, with his left hand, or if he had a cocaine problem? I mean, that's so not part of the narrative that we're celebrating when we put him in the Hall of Fame. So
what if an athlete raped a girl?
I'm not certain that has anything to do with his athletic ability.
Paul, anybody want to take that? What if a great athlete raped a girl?
I mean, I don't want to do some kind of character evaluation of everybody who we put in the Hall of Fame.
Why not? We do. We vote on them. We vote on them, right? We vote on everybody. It's not you're not
That's
just automatic. It's
ability.
Not a metric. You vote. Yeah, it's a decision.
The metric should be their athletic skills, not their character as a human being, because if we do that, then a whole lot of people are going to come out of the Hall of Fame.
That's right. It's going to be mad energy.
And that's why I say I think their narrative should be a part of their plaque. Their narrative
but he
should
doesn't
be
think so.
Their,
you think it should. Why?
I think it should be because I think it's important to see Lynn Bias as one of us as well. He's an extraordinary athlete that most of us cannot be, but he also had a tragic flaw. And I think other people, there are people in halls of fame who have committed criminal acts. And I think that should be a part of it.
Okay. I agree completely.
All right. 2-2. You know, listen, I mean, it's funny because this is one of those, we have another like straight down divide, like 2-2 on this. I don't know what that means. I guess it means it's hard. Maybe it's a hard question. I don't know. You're listening to our weekly Barbershop Roundtable. We're joined by writer Jimmy Israel, law professor Paul Butler, sports writer and professor Kevin Blackstone, and healthcare consultant Neil Minkoff. Back to you, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Interestingly enough, the decision came down after the Barbershop guys met last week. Coincidence? Anyway, you know, as you guys know, I'm not a hater, but it's weird that all of a sudden Cleveland has got love for him again. You know, I guess they figure I'm back, LeBron's back. You know, the possibilities are endless. But you know, I don't know. People look at him as kind of a role model, and or people want to put him up there as a role model. And I'm hard line on this. Your parents should be a role model. Anybody that's carrying a basketball is just carrying a basketball. I mean, they can't teach you anything about life necessarily. But Kevin Blackstone, you mm-hmm. wrote a column saying sports and the world need more quote unquote activists like LeBron James. Why so much for the Bronski?
Well, because I'm looking at his development over the past 4 years. I'm looking at the fact that no one was more unequivocal in his disgust for Donald Sterling as a player than was LeBron James, who vowed not to play another game if Donald Sterling is still connected to the NBA. I look at the protest over Trayvon Martin that he staged along with Dwayne Wade, which I thought was very powerful. I look at the voice that he's had behind closed doors with the union, pointing out what he believes to be an inequitable economic relationship with the owners. So I see in LeBron James, you know, the son of a single parent who didn't go to college, who started playing a man's game for money as a mere teenager, and look at his development, and I think it's been remarkable, and I think he's. You know, I think he's turned himself into a real spokesperson for professional athletes in this country.
Paul, what do you think? I'm curious. The reason I'm curious about your take on this is your book, Let's Get Free, is about how not famous people can have an impact on the things that are very much present in their lives, like the criminal justice system. Like one of the things you talk about is things like do your jury duty. You know, don't shirk your jury duty. You know, go and, you know, step up for things like that. And what's your take on that?
You know, LeBron James, mad props. He's the citizen athlete of our time. The subtitle of my book was A Hip-Hop Theory of Justice. And I always get these questions, well, what about hip-hop artists? Are they involved in the struggle? And the answer is most of them no, because they're too concerned about paper, just like a lot of athletes. All they want is their money. Michael Jordan's famous comment, Republicans buy sneakers too. So, you know, I have so much respect for LeBron James. He's doing for athletes and civic engagement what Magic is doing for athletes and business development. So I hope he goes into politics after his NBA career, especially in Jimmy's mad conservative Cleveland, Ohio.
Neil, what do you think?
I don't have any disagreement with that. I think that what LeBron has said and done is very mature. It's a potentially dangerous place for him to be. Not truly dangerous, but you know, could be limiting. There's always that fine line between the public statements becoming too much or appearing preachy, but he certainly does not seem to me as if he's crossed that line yet. And the fact that so much of it has been thinking global, acting local, and so much of what he wrote and said has been about his hometown and where he comes from and helping the kids there, that it would certainly deflect from a lot of any criticism that could arise
from
him seeming to be too...
What did you mean by dangerous? You mean the sense that the hype couldn't possibly meet, that the expectations can't possibly be met? Is that what you meant?
Or people getting tired of being, you know, talked to or activism is a double-edged sword. I mean, ask Kareem about that. You know, Kareem has written many times that he thinks the fact that he was so outspoken really limited his opportunities to participate in basketball after his playing days were done. I know tons of people who love the music, but they've been to see Eddie Vedder and Pearl Jam in concert and they don't want to be preached to. So I think that's the issue, is could there be an economic downside if he crosses that line? But I don't think he's crossed it.
Well, let me, before we go, Jimmy, you're the Clevelander here. Cleveland's going to host the opening ceremony for the Gay Games this summer. LeBron is back, of course. The Republican National Committee announced that they're going to hold the 2016 convention there. So,
and I'm here.
Of course.
Jimmy.
Well, that's probably why they're all going.
Right. I'm trying to tell you.
So is Cleveland back?
Well, I'm hoping that LeBron got a teaching certification while he was in Florida, because the Cleveland schools desperately need some good substitutes. So I don't know for a fact that Cleveland – I don't know if we can call it a comeback, hashtag LL Cool J, but I think we're going in the right direction. If we could just get the schools on track, as a parent, that's my concern. I'm troubled that we live in a city where people – are more concerned about the sports, and people are misspelling LeBron's name on the back of jerseys, and we're not concerned about the schools. The schools are not great. So it's certainly the right direction. I mean, the river's not on fire.
I hope that I'm not disappointing, but there is one more sports thing I did want to talk about, which is something that's kind of personal interest to me, which is as a woman journalist who sometimes covers things. I've never been a sports journalist per se, but I'm a person who's covered a lot of things that a lot of women sometimes have not covered. And, you know, Pam Oliver, longtime NFL sports reporter, most famous for being on the sideline, being replaced by Erin Andrews. She's going to move to the number two announcing team, and then she's going to move off the sidelines sort of all together. And look, Kevin, you're the sports guy. I have to ask, what's up with that?
Well, as soon as they signed Erin Andrews several months ago, the writing was on the wall that was pretty much the end of Pam Oliver's FaceTime on Fox.
Because she's 53? Because people like to change their cast? Why?
She's great at her job.
She asks great questions. She clearly knows the game. She doesn't play the wink, wink, nod, like,
exactly,
talk to me because I'm cute game.
But she's not Erin Andrews. And Erin Andrews has become a phenomena in television broadcasting and in commercial sports the last several years, and she was the hottest commodity out there. What concerns me about this is the loss of another black face and black voice in sports broadcasting, particularly when it comes to women. She was almost pretty much alone, with the exception of a couple of women who do some lesser games on ESPN. But also, I don't even know how to put this, but blonde white women who continue to get opportunities. Erin Andrews really doesn't fit into that because she's really very good at her job.
I was going to say, she got her job.
But so. I have women who are in my class at the University of Maryland who sometimes ask whether or not they'll be able to get that far given that they don't fit this particular aesthetic. And I think that's disconcerting.
Neil, what do you think?
I think it's I think the really fascinating thing is that TV, it certainly seems as if, look, they're going with the cute blonde, right? But I haven't seen one positive comment about it, right? All of the pushback has been kind of like the way we're discussing, which is Pam Oliver is a fantastic reporter. She is basically a legend. She's been doing this and doing this at a high level for a very long time. Why replace her with a face? I mean, what I know about Erin Andrews, even as a guy who watches a lot of sport, is that someone filmed her in a hotel room and she takes probiotics. I don't know anything more about her. Where Pam Oliver was someone I respected, and that's been the pushback. So who do they think they're pleasing with these moves?
You all.
The male audience.
Well, that's who they were pleasing 20 years ago when they hired Pam Oliver. She got that job because she had skills and because then she was young and hot. So how much can she complain now when the next young and hot girl comes along?
Mm. Okay, Jimmy, what do you think?
I don't think it's ageism. I think it's racism. Pam Oliver doesn't appeal to the core demographic, you know, and I think sometimes big media thinks racism is good business. That's what I think.
But they have all those. They have all those African American men who are doing commentary. So I love watching football now because I like seeing all the black commentators. So it's an instance where you can't say it's no racism because they're men, black men who are hired. You can't exactly say it's sexism because white women get hired. It's this black women are in between and they get pushed out.
It's interesting I think you were making a good point. Like Pam Oliver's got the 20 years on it. She wasn't Pam Oliver 20 years ago. She wasn't as great as she is now. I mean, she grew into being great. So maybe Erin Andress will grow into being great, you know, as well. It's an interesting question. Mm-hmm. Maybe the lines aren't as bright anymore, but even though maybe they are. It's hard to complain when another woman gets a job because if she has mad skills, and we'll see. So I don't know. All right, here we go. Jimmy Israel is a writer. You can find his blog at jimmyisrael.com. Neil Minkoff is a healthcare consultant and contributor to the conservative magazine National Review Online. Kevin Blackstone is a sports columnist, professor of journalism at the University of Maryland. Paul Butler is a law professor at Georgetown University. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Woof woof.
Yeah.
And remember, if you can't get enough Barbershop Buzz on the radio, look for our Barbershop podcast. That's in the iTunes store or at npr.org. That's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin. This is Tell Me More from NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Let's talk more on Monday.